defensive of instrumental music in worship. I grew up in a denomination that used instrumental music in worship. As a matter of fact, the church I grew up in had a orchestra, and it had a brass section of your trombones and tubas and trumpets. It had a wind section of your clarinets and things of that nature. It had your those are reeds, I guess, instead of wind. But anyway, it had all kinds of instruments in there. I know from my memory, I can see in my mind's eye at least 12 members of that orchestra with the different types of musical instruments, as well as the piano and the organ. And I know it's piano. I do like to say piano every now and then. And then, you know, every now and then we'd have a group of ladies come out, and they would be the a cappella choir. And you could hear the ladies who could sing without instrumental accompaniment. Now, I'll have more to say about that in a little bit, but almost all of the singing was accompanied by man-made musical instruments. There was a fellow one time that was visiting the church there, and he sang a special for the church, and he accompanied himself on a guitar, and there was some controversy about that. Some of them didn't just seem much like a guitar in the worship, and what are you going to say? You got your tuba and your trombone, and you got your clarinet down there, and you got your, I don't think they had any percussion drums or anything like that, but they even had a harp. I remember that. You know, other things, what? How can you say there's anything wrong with a guitar? But, you know, some of them just didn't like that. And the most common defense, of course, you hear from people, the most common defense of instrumental music is, well, I just don't see anything wrong with it. Look, what difference really does it make that somebody doesn't see anything wrong with it? Did the Lord ask you? He didn't ask me. And, yeah, I didn't see anything wrong with a lot of things growing up. You know, not seeing anything wrong with it doesn't mean it's authorized. That just means you might not have studied well enough to see that it's not authorized. So I'm not going to handle that one. I'm not going to deal with that one so much except to say that it doesn't really matter whether a particular individual sees anything wrong with it or not. But I'm going to mention some of the others that at least have a semblance of being biblically based. And there are several defenses that have seem to have a biblical basis. For example, some claim to find authorization in the Old Testament. Well, at least they're going to the someplace in the Bible, and they're going beyond this idea of I don't see anything wrong with it. At least they're saying, well, you know, we find it in the Bible in the Old Testament, and that's true. We do find references to. We do find references to instrumental music in the Bible, in the Old Testament. But notice what Jesus said in Matthew 28:18. Jesus came and spoke to them, saying, all authority has been given me in heaven and on earth. And so there's no authority. Moses doesn't have any authority in the New Testament church. It is true that the Old Testament authorized the use of man-made musical instruments in Jewish worship. David wrote Psalms commanding the use of a variety of musical instruments. They were told to praise the Lord on this or that instrument. But David doesn't have any authority in the New Testament church. Moses didn't have any authority in the New Testament church. No Old Testament prophet has any authority in the New Testament church. But as Jesus said in Matthew 28:18, all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. And so whatever we're going to do in the New Testament church, if we're going to have authority for it, if it's going to be right, then that authority must come from Jesus Christ. He has all authority in heaven and on earth. And Moses has none. And David has none. has none. Jeremiah has none. Zechariah, Zephaniah, Malachi, they had authority under the law to tell the people what God inspired them to tell the people. And certainly we ought to go back and teach what they taught the people as historical and as factual. But what they taught those people to do is not necessarily right for us to do unless Jesus authorized it. If Jesus authorized it, then of course we can do it. In Luke chapter 9, verse 28 through 31, we read, "Now it came to pass about 8 days after these things that he took Peter, John, and James and went out on the mountain to pray. And as he prayed, the appearance of his face was altered, and his robe became white and glistening. And behold, two men talked with him, who were Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spoke of his deceit, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. And so here Jesus is with James and Peter and John, James and John, sons of Zebedee, and Peter, brother to Andrew. These three formed the inner circle of disciples. There were times when they were with Jesus when the other nine disciples or apostles were not with him. And when Jesus went into Gethsemane to pray, for example, on the night he was betrayed, he left, at that time there was only 11 remaining because Judas had already gone and betrayed Jesus. He had already gone over to the other side, so to speak. And so Jesus left 8 there outside the garden, took Peter, James, and John with him into the garden, and he posted them, and then he went even further into the garden. You might remember, they were the inner circle of disciples. And so here he is with them on the mountain. And he's praying. And the appearance of his face was altered, and his robe became white and glistening. And behold, two men talked with him who were Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spoke of his deceit, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. But Peter and those with him were heavy with sleep. And when they were fully awake, this is not a dream, they were asleep, but they were fully awake now, and they perceived, here is Moses and Elijah talking to Jesus. They saw his glory and the two men who stood with him. By the way, I would liken this change in the appearance of Jesus, I would liken that to what Saul of Tarsus saw on the road to Damascus. You might remember it was noon, and he saw bright light above the brightness of the noonday sun, and the voice saying, "Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me?" Jesus, his countenance was changed here. His glory shone through his earthly human skin, and they saw the glory of an individual they had never seen this glory before. But notice what happened here. Then it happened, as they were parting from him, that is, Moses and Elijah, that Peter said to Jesus, "Master, it is good for us to be here. Let us make 3 tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah," not knowing what he said. Peter, in his own special way, we talked a little bit about Peter. He was an impetuous individual. He would oftentimes speak before his brain was in gear. He thinks he is elevating Jesus to the level of Moses and Elijah, when really he's elevating Moses and Elijah to the level of Jesus in this. That's why Luke adds he really didn't really know what he's talking about. He thinks he's putting Jesus on the pedestal, when he's really bringing Jesus down, or putting Moses and Elijah up there with Jesus, when he ought not to have done that. And notice what happens next. While he was saying this, a cloud came and overshadowed them, and they were fearful as they entered the cloud. And a voice came out of the cloud saying, "This is my beloved Son, hear him." When the voice had ceased, Jesus was found alone. But they kept quiet and told no one in those days of any of the things they had seen. And so God spoke from heaven and told Peter, James, and John, "This is my beloved Son." In other words, he is to be elevated above Moses and Elijah. Moses, the great lawgiver. Elijah, the great prophet. I used to wonder why Elijah and not Isaiah. But after I studied Elijah, I decided The only ones who don't really appreciate Elijah are the ones who haven't studied Elijah. Elijah's a great prophet to the northern kingdom. Stood toe-to-toe with 850 false prophets on Mount Carmel. And after the failure of those 850 prophets to call upon Baal to consume their sacrifice, Elijah calls upon Jehovah to consume his sacrifice, and it happens in an instant. And Elijah tells the people, slay all these false prophets, and they slew all those false prophets. And then Jezebel gives Elijah 24 hours to get out of town, and he gets the ground running. But a great prophet, he accomplished much. And yet, Jesus is elevated above him because as great as Elijah was, he was not the Son of God. As great as Moses was, he was not the Son of God. But Jesus is the beloved Son of God. And God says here, him. And so that was indicative of the fact that one day soon, when the kingdom is established, Jesus would have all authority, which is, of course, what he later said in Matthew 28 that we've already looked at. In Hebrews 1, verses 1 and 2, God, who has spoken at various times and in various ways, spoken time past to the fathers about the prophets, has in these last days spoken to us by his Son, whom he has appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the world. Yet, when he spoke to the fathers, when he spoke to the people under the law, he spoke by the prophets. But now he's spoken to us by his Son. And so his Son has to authorize it, if it is going to be authorized at all. And so neither Moses nor the Old Testament prophets have any authority today. In Luke chapter 16, you have the account of the rich man and Lazarus. Not Lazarus, the brother of Mary and Martha, but another man named Lazarus, who was a beggar, and a rich man. And they both died, and Lazarus was in Abraham's bosom, and the rich man was in torment. And you might remember the rich man sees Abraham afar off and Lazarus in his embrace, and he says, Abraham, or Father Abraham, send Lazarus to my brother's house, or my father's house. I've got five brothers. I don't want them to come to this awful place. And Abraham says, no, they've got Moses and the prophets. Let them hear them. No, but if you send one from the dead, they'll believe. No, they'll repent. No. If they will not hear Moses and the prophets, neither will they repent, though one is raised from the dead. Now, they had Moses and the prophets. We've got Jesus and the apostles. We need to understand that. If Jesus didn't authorize it, whether personally or through his apostles, it's not authorized. Christians are to worship according to the New Testament, and so it's not sufficient to say, well, they had instrumental music in the Old Testament. Yes, but the Old Testament was nailed to the cross. It is of no authority today where worship and work of the Lord's people are concerned. In Galatians 1, verses 6 through 9, Paul wrote, I marvel that you are turning away so soon from him who called you in the grace of Christ to a different gospel, which is not another. But there are some who trouble you and want to pervert the gospel of Christ. But even if we are an angel from heaven, preach any other gospel to you than what we have preached you, let it be accursed. As we have said before, so say I now again. If anyone preaches any other gospel to you than what you have received, let him be accursed. What were they doing? They were perverting the gospel. How have they perverted the gospel? They perverted the gospel by taking things from the Old Testament and binding it on people who were living under the New Testament. Physical circumcision. Oh, you've got to be circumcised. Lawkeeping. You've got to keep the law. And other things that weren't even binding on the Jews. They were trying to bind them on the Gentiles, on Christians. But if by taking things from the law and binding them on Christians is wrong, what about taking things that weren't even in the law? See, it doesn't matter if I don't see anything wrong with it. Even if God authorized it for Israel, that wouldn't make it all right for us. If it wouldn't be all right to take something God authorized for Israel and use that in our worship, why would it be all right to do something that I don't see anything wrong with, though Jesus himself has to authorize it? Colossians 3:17, whatever you do in word or deed, that's in teaching or practice, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through him. We can't do it in the name of Moses. Moses has no standing. We can't do it in the name of David. David has no standing. We can't do it in the name of Isaiah or Ezekiel or Elijah or Elisha for that matter, or Zephaniah or Zechariah. Or I can't do it in the name of any of those people because they don't have any standing in the New Testament. Again, we can go back and study what they said to Israel. And we need to do that. We can go back and look at characters that were developed or characters that was developed during those times and show that the character that those people had, those people who were people of faith, such as mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11, that that's the kind of character we need to have. But we don't go back and say, well, what they did, we ought to do. You might as well say, well, you know, Noah built an ark. I was just building an ark and please God that way. Well, no, God didn't tell you to build an ark. Abraham already saw an Isaac on as a sacrifice. Not offer my son. No, God didn't tell you to do that. Matter of fact, Abraham did it in his mind's eye, but he didn't actually do it because the Lord stayed his hand. But it don't go back. You know, it's funny how you talk to people about water baptism. They don't go to the rich young man whom Jesus said, sell everything you have. They go to the man on the cross where Jesus said, today you'll be in paradise. Now, he was on the cross. He was not in a position to do anything, but he had manifested faith. And they go, well, I don't want to do that. Make them go to him. Jesus didn't tell him to do that thing. Why don't they go back to the rich young ruler? Jesus said, sell everything you have. They don't want to sell everything they have. That's why they don't go back to him. But it makes just as much sense to go back to him and say, well, you got to sell everything you have. That's what to go back to the thief on the cross. They wasn't just be with Jesus in paradise. But whatever you do in word or deed, do all. In the name of Lord Jesus, that means do it in recognition of his authority, having authority from him, giving thanks to God the Father through him. If we're doing things in our worship, whether we're talking about teaching or practice, and we don't have authority from Jesus for it, we cannot give thanks to God through the Father through Jesus in doing that thing. And so we've got to have authority from Jesus or from the New Testament. Hebrews 2 verses 1 through 3, therefore we must give them more earnest heed, the things we have heard, lest we drift away. Here I believe the writer is contrasting the things which the fathers have heard from the prophets in the Old Testament. Contrasting those things with the things that they themselves had heard from Jesus and the apostles. Whereas the word spoken through angels, the Old Testament, pretty steadfast. Angels there probably should be messengers. And every transgression, and this will be interesting, the just reward. How shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? Which at the first began to be spoken by the Lord and was confirmed to us by those who heard him. The way you hear some people teach it, salvation was not did not first begin to be spoken by the Lord, but first began to be spoken by Moses. They make no distinction between Noah's salvation and the salvation of somebody out of the New Testament. But again, nobody is commanded to build an ark today. Noah was Noah a man of faith? Yes, Noah was a man of faith. He had to have faith. Faith has always been a requirement of God. God's requirement of man. But faith has not always been manifested in the same way because people were under different laws. And so Noah, he manifested his faith by building an ark, because that's what God told him to do. Abraham manifested his faith by taking Isaac up on that high mountain and preparing him as a sacrifice to God, because that's what God told him to do. You think it was done any good for Noah when he came down off the ark to strap Shem down? Alright, Shem, I'm going to offer you as a sacrifice to God now. Sorry, but I just feel in my heart that's what I ought to do. I don't see anything wrong with it either. Now, it would have been wrong for Noah to do that, because God didn't command Noah to do that. It would have been wrong for Abraham to say, well, you know, I love Isaac, I'll take Ishmael up there. God didn't command him to take Ishmael up there. Commanded him to take Isaac up there. And of course, he stayed his hand once it was obvious that Abraham would have gone through with it. Now, the salvation, New Testament salvation, began to be spoken by the Lord, and it's different from Old Testament salvation. All of that was simply figurative or preparatory for what we have under the New Testament. The first spoken by the Lord, confirmed to us by those who heard him. So it doesn't matter if it's in the Old Testament. Some claim to find authorization in the New Testament book of Revelation. Well, at least they're in the right book. At least they're in the right testament. I'll give you credit for that. And they'll say, well, after all, they're going to be hearts in heaven, aren't they? And I've turned to the book of Revelation and talked all about the hearts there. And there's certainly their hearts missions there. Well, if their hearts there, then why can't we use instruments of music? The book of Revelation contains several visions in which parts are prominent. Revelation 5:8, for example, now when he had taken the scroll, talking to Jesus, the four living creatures, and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, each having a harp, 24 hearts in it, 28 hearts, and golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. Now, obviously, when it talks about these golden bowls full of incense, it's not being literal. These golden bowls full of incense are the prayers of the saints. It's figurative. Heart, so the heart there is probably, these hearts are probably not literal hearts either. I tell you what, if they are literal, they're certainly not man-made. You reckon they had somebody on earth, commissioned somebody on earth to make all them hearts? No. Heavenly hearts, not man-made hearts, and so certainly not physical hearts. Revelation 14:2, I heard a voice from heaven like the voice of many waters, and like the voice of loud thunder, and I heard the sound of harpists playing their harps. Under this voice of heaven, this voice from heaven was like the voice of many waters. It was like the voice of loud thunder. It wasn't a waterfall. It wasn't a raging, mighty river like the Amazon River. It wasn't a loud thunder, but it was powerful, like the voice of many waters, like the violent voice of thunder. And I heard the sound of harpists playing with their harps. That's the sound of it, but what was it? Is that literal or is that figurative? And that's in Romans, Revelation 15, verse 6. I saw something like a sea of glass mingled with fire, and those who have the victory over the beast, over his image, and over his mark, and over the number of his name, standing on the sea of glass, having hearts of God. Are you and have hearts in you? Is that a sea of literal glass? No, that's a figure of speech. Glass mingled with fire? No, it's something like a sea of glass mingled with fire. It's figurative. It's not literal. Why should the hearts be considered literal? So these are highly figurative visions, apparently of things occurring whether now or in the future in heaven. Are those heavenly visions, visions of heaven, people in heaven, four living creatures, 24 elders, and all these angels, having hearts, playing on these hearts. Even if the hearts are somehow literal, they are certainly not man-made. I guess I made that point prematurely, probably. They're not man-made hearts. They're not literal hearts at all. They're part of this vision, simply talking about the worship of God and how beautiful that is in heaven, whether now or in the future. If when I get to heaven, God hands me a harp, I will play it to the best of my ability. I've seen a few people play harps. I don't know that I can play it beautifully like they do, but I've got an idea about how to play one. You rest that thing up against your shoulder like that, you just stroke those strings. I did the best of my ability if God handed me one. I don't think it's going to do that. But what difference does it make? What is done in heaven? What we're talking about is what may be done on the earth. Where in the New Testament are Christians authorized to use harps and worship while on earth? I don't know if they ever thought about it in Highland Park Baptist Church after they left in. They had one. Had a harp. But you know, specific authority for a harp would not provide generic authority for all other instruments. So they have harps. Let's say they justify the harps in the New Testament worship. It wouldn't justify a piano, because that's another specific, you see. Wouldn't justify a trumpet. That's another class of instruments. Harp is a stringed instrument. Trumpet is a brass instrument. Would not write a wind instrument. All it would authorize is harps. But again, when we get to New Testament worship, the worship of Christians in the first century, we don't see any man-made musical instruments. What is the third argument? Some claim that the Greek word solo and solos necessarily imply the use of a musical instrument. Well, again, please, we're dealing with New Testament Greek here. We're dealing with the language of the New Testament. So again, it's not like I don't see anything wrong with it. At least it's based on something found in the New Testament. The word solo and the word solos, those are words in the New Testament. But let's see if this stands up. Solo is variously translated as sing songs and making melody. It's never translated play an instrument. It's a verb, and thus it has to have an object, either implied or stated. There's never a man-made use of musical instrument that is the object of the verb solo. It always translated sing songs, or making melody. Psalmos is a noun, and it simply is songs. And the only thing we're ever told to do with reference to songs in the New Testament is sing them. We're not told that singing and playing songs, or playing songs, but singing to yourself, singing to one another in psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. And so if it's something that is to be sung, it might be something that could be played, but you'd still have to have the verb play in order to authorize that. In Romans 15, verse 9, now may the God of patience and comfort grant you to be like-minded toward one another, according to Christ Jesus, and that the Gentiles might glorify God for his mercy, as it is written, for this reason, I will confess you among the Gentiles and sing to your name. All right, here is a quotation from the Old Testament, fulfilled with an Old Testament prophecy. And the implication is that Jesus would confess God the Father among the Gentiles and sing to his name. Now, Jesus did say, we're two or three gathered together, I'm in this problem. So, when we gather together by his authority and we worship and serve God by his authority, he's right here with us. And so he's singing with us, he's giving with us, he's eating the Lord's Supper with us, he's engaged in the worship with us. He has a spiritual presence here. Sing to your name. In 1 Corinthians 14, 15, what is the conclusion? That I will pray with the Spirit, and I also pray with understanding. I will sing with the Spirit, and I also sing with the understanding. Sing with the Spirit, not play with the Spirit. Sing with the understanding, not play with the understanding. Is anyone among you suffering? Let him pray. Is anyone cheerful? Let him sing songs. Not sing and play songs, but sing songs. Speaking of one another, psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs, singing, making melody in the hearts of the Lord. Again, the only verb attached to psalms is singing and then making melody. Now, the melody, can you make melody on a piano? Well, yeah, you can make melody on a piano. Can you make melody on a clarinet? Yeah, you can make melody on a clarinet. Can you make melody on a brass instrument? The trombone? Well, yeah. Heart? Yeah. But where did he say to make melody? Make melody in your heart. And when you get a heart in your heart, then you can make melody on it. Colossians 3:16, let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. Alright, what's the verb? Teaching and admonishing. That's what we're doing with psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. Singing, not playing, with grace in your heart to the Lord. So when we sing the psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs, we are teaching and we are admonishing one another. Well, a man-made instrument can't do those things, teach and admonish. In Romans 15, verse 9, Paul is quoting an Old Testament prophecy. It's found in two different places, 2 Samuel 22:50 and Psalm 18:49. Therefore, I will give thanks to you, O Lord, among the Gentiles, and sing praises to your name. And the only verb there is sing praises. The only verb has anything to do with music. We must interpret Old Testament prophecy in the light of New Testament fulfillment. Certainly under the Old Testament they could play. But because we find that prophecy in the Old Testament, that doesn't mean that we could play. Because we're under the New Testament, we have to find authority for what we do there. In 1 Corinthians 14:15, the singing is to be done with the Spirit and with the understanding. Never is it to be done with a musical instrument. In Ephesians 5:19, the melody should be made in your heart. I know of no instrument other than the human voice and the human heart that is anywhere authorized for use in New Testament worship. The voice box is a musical instrument. It is a musical instrument designed by God. When you sing, you can make music. You might not can make pleasant music. You might not can carry a tune in a bucket. But when you sing, you are making music. And when you hum, you're making music, but we're not authorized to hum, you see. Teaching and admonishing one another. It's all this spiritual. Singing with grace in your heart to the Lord. And so the human voice, a physical instrument, and the human heart, a spiritual instrument. We're talking about the human heart. We're not talking about the blood pump. We're talking about the inner man. We're talking about the intellect, the emotions, the conscience, and the will. And the melody in your heart, you've got to mean what you sing. Some argue, this is argument number four, some argue that musical instruments are just aids, but just songbooks. Well, again, at least they're showing some creativity here, and they're showing some understanding of the nature of aids. Certainly, something that aids an authorized act would be authorized by implication. Authorized as an aid. And songbooks certainly do aid us in the singing. I don't know how many of you have committed to memory the songs number 214, number 210, both beautiful songs, but I haven't committed those words to memory. And 325, even though I marked that song just a few moments ago to be sung as invitation, I don't know right now what that song is, and I might not be able to sing all the words to it without a songbook. So the songbook, it does aid us in our singing, but when we use songbooks, what are we doing? We're singing. Besides, songbooks can be an aid to singing, and they can also be an aid to playing. Pianist puts the songbook up there and on the bookboard there, and knows what notes to play on the piano. The organist does. Well, if a songbook can use as an aid to singing and as an aid to playing, then it's not like playing, is it? The playing is like the singing, but the songbook is not like the singing. And so the playing can't be like the songbook. Songbook can be either singing vocal music or playing instrumental music. When singers use songbooks, no other music is created, but when man-made instruments accompany the singers, playing is added to the singing. And so it's all right to use the songbook as an aid to the singing, but if you use the songbook as an aid to playing, then you're creating a different kind of music that is not authorized. Singing is authorized. Playing is simply not authorized. Since singing is authorized, it may be added. But since playing is not authorized, it may not be used. Much less aided. You've got to show authority for the thing itself before you can say, well, this is just an aid to it. Although, again, they're not saying that the songbook is an aid to the music, to the playing, which it would be. They're saying that the music, the playing is an aid to the singing. Now, it's a different kind of music. And the songbook can be an aid to either, and that shows that the singing and the playing are alike. That the songbook and the playing are not alike. That playing is obviously more like singing than it is like songbook. It cannot logically be considered an aid to the singing, but must be considered as an addition or a substitution. An addition if you're doing that in addition to singing, a substitution if you're doing that instead of singing. And certain instruments can be played, and the player can still sing. People can play a piano and still sing, so it wouldn't be a substitution necessarily. People can play other instruments and still sing, so it would be a substitution, but you can't hardly play a clarinet and sing at the same time, can you? So for the clarinetist, at least, for the flutist, it would be a substitution, not an addition. Some, in a last-ditch attempt to cling to the use of the instrument, but being unable to show authority for its use in a New Testament worship, claim that they can use it at certain stated times. For example, outside the formal collective worship of congregations, so long as they are not actually worshiping. But
For some, they may be entertaining one.
Well, you know, if you're just entertaining one another, you can use songs in the church, sing songs in the church, songs in the middle of the town. It's just entertainment. It's not worship. Well, let's think about that for a second. If they are singing without actually worshiping, are they not misusing the psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs? The only thing we're told to do with psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs is teach and admonish with them. Singing them to teach and admonish. So that's a form of worship. When we're teaching the truth and admonishing people to obey the truth, we're worshiping God. It's a part of our worship. Would this not be like giving alms, praying, and fasting to be seen of men like the hypocrites in Matthew 6, 1 through 8? Nothing wrong with giving alms. Nothing wrong with fasting. Nothing wrong with praying. Praying in public. But if you don't have to be seen of men, that's the wrong motive. Or if you use the psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs to entertain, then that's as much a misuse of the psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs as giving alms and fasting and praying to be seen of men is a misuse of those things. Matthew 6:22, take heed that you do not do your charitable deeds before men to be seen by them. Otherwise, you have no reward from your Father in heaven. Therefore, when you do a charitable deed, do not count as something before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may have reward from men. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. Now, here he's not talking about sounding a trumpet in worship. Here he's talking, it'd be wrong, but here he's talking about, of course this is under the law, sounding a trumpet in order to call attention to what you're doing. No. You don't call attention to what you're doing when you're doing a terrible deed. That's to be seen of men. That's the wrong motive, you see. Once they receive the reward from men, they've received their reward. What do they have to look forward to? Nothing. When you do a charitable deed, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, that your charitable deed may be in secret. And your Father who sees it, secret will himself reward you openly. And when you pray, you shall not be like the hypocrites, for they love to pray standing in the synagogue and on the corners of the streets, that they may be seen by men. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. He's not condemning praying in public. He's condemning praying to be seen of men, you see. Why, that's a misuse of prayer. That's not what prayer is. Prayer was not designed so that you could receive glory from men. The giving of charitable deeds should not be for the purpose of being seen by men. But you, when you pray, go into your room, and when you have shut your door, pray to your Father who is in the secret place. And your Father who sees in secret will reward you openly. And when you pray, do not use vain repetitions as the heathen do, for they think that they will be heard for their many words. Therefore, do not be like them. For your Father knows the things you have need of before you ask him. And so there's a misuse of prayer, a misuse of giving alms, a misuse of fasting, and there can be a misuse of the psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. Secondly, if they are singing and making melody in the hearts of the Lord, it is worship. Whether it's inside the church building, in an assembly called by the church or not, if they're singing and making melody in the hearts of the Lord, how is that not worship? Even if it's in the home. If they're singing with grace in the heart of the Lord, it is worship. How can it not be worship? If they are not making melody in the heart of the Lord, or they are not singing with grace in the heart of the Lord, why are they not? Say, well, we're not really making melody in the heart of the Lord on this. We're just entertaining worship. We're not singing with grace in the heart of the Lord. Why not? Why aren't you making melody in your heart of the Lord? Why aren't you singing with grace in the heart of the Lord when you're singing songs, yeah, and spiritual songs? Would they not be drawing nigh to God with their mouth and honoring God with their lips while their heart is far from it? If they're not making melody in their heart, if they're not singing with grace in their heart, when they're singing songs to the church, how can they say they are worshiping God? And would they not fall into the same condemnation as the Jews during the time of Isaiah and those during the time of Jesus? Would this not be vain worship according to Matthew 15:8-9? Jesus said, these people draw near to me with their mouths and honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. And in vain they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. Well, I certainly don't want to be guilty of that. As far as I've been able to determine, except for, I don't think anything wrong with it, I know of no other defenses than those dealt with here. There's no authority in the New Testament for instrumental music and worship, whether in or out of the congregational assembly. while trying to sing psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs in order to teach and admonish one another. No other authorized use of psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs for Christians, whether they are acting alone or whether they're acting collectively. So that's all we do here when we sing. We sing psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. We don't have a piano, not because we can't afford one, but because there's simply no authority when we don't need one. You know, the great reformers, at least John Wesley and John Calvin, both opposed the use of instrumental music in worship simply because there was no authority for it. Same grounds on which churches of Christ opposed it. Does that? And that people who claim to follow John Wesley and John Calvin, they want to use it. They don't think anything wrong with it. If they want to do it, they're going to do it. You need to make your heart right with God. We encourage you to resolve to delay no longer. If you need to obey God as an alien sinner, becoming a Christian, or as a child of God who's not been faithful and needs to pretend.